Hello, everybody. One little thing I'd like to mention first of all, and I have a strange reason for bringing this up, and that is, if any of you want to make notes, you're free to do that. You're free to do what you want. But I found more and more that when someone is writing notes, it's actually like, it's a bit like, you know, having the camera stuck so much in front of your face taking photographs that you don't actually see what you're taking photos of. And from my point, it's fine, you know, from your point of view, it's fine, you can do what you wish. From my point of view, I just have to say this, that I depend on the energy in this room. I can't say anything unless there is a consciousness in you that draws something out through me. Otherwise, I'd just be sitting here like a beanbag or something. And what actually happens is, I've seen it sometimes, we create a certain container by being together, an energetic container, a container of consciousness. When people write notes, it's very interesting. It's like a leak in the boat, because the attention is actually going somewhere else rather than being fed back into the room. So this is just something for any of you who do like writing notes to look at. As I say, you're free to do that. But just, I've noticed it's like somewhere, you know, I need your attention. I don't think this is really talked about very much. We're so used to this lecturer audience scenario. But I need your attention, or something needs your attention. Something desperately needs your attention. Not your mental attention, but something deeper. And the only way to offer that attention is actually by being present in this room. In spite of the uncomfortable chairs, we'll be able to lie down soon, so don't worry about that. But just this little flowering of attention, as the ancients used to call it. It's a very beautiful expression. Anthos nous, the flower of consciousness. Come quickly before the door's shut. So in coming here this afternoon, you have come to a black hole in this conference. There are many wonderful things being done and said and practiced to hopefully lead us to a certain state of nothingness eventually. And here we start with the nothingness. We die at the beginning. We begin with the blackness, end with the blackness. It's just very simple, a little bit primitive and creaky and obscure and strange, but that's the way we do it. Very, very archaic way of doing things. This is a primitive, this is a primordial Sufism. Goes back way before Islam. You're okay? I'm very, very conscious of something with this Sufi conference, which I never noticed before. Maybe it happened before and I was just too thick, I didn't notice it. But I've had the impression at past Sufi conferences I've been to, it's a bit like, you know, people have had their different sideshows. And you go along and you kind of go here or there or there, and it's a goodie here and it's lovely there, and people get nourished. But everybody was just doing their thing under this invisible arching structure, which I believe was the intention of these conferences to begin with, but I think that that arching structure was not very much noticed. But I feel very, very strongly this time that everything has become very permeable and interpenetrating. If find it incredibly beautiful. To me, it's as if the purpose of the Sufi conferences has at last been fulfilled this time. Things bleed into each other. They leak into each other. And that is very, very beautiful. And in this very small way, best I can, I would like to try to contribute to this process. As I say, this is a primordial Sufism that we work with. It's very ancient, and possibly it can take you deeper into yourself so that you can do what you already do in a deeper and more complete and more fulfilling and fulfilled way. Now, one of the practices of this primordial ancient tradition that I belong to is called incubation. It's a bit of a terrifying word, because it has, you know, connotations like diseases incubate, or well, chickens, hens incubating. But literally, incubate means, it comes from the Latin incubatio, that comes from an ancient Greek word. It means to lie down in, to lie down inside. And traditionally, people would lie down in dark places. They would lie down, often in caves, in shrines. The birds are happy. You mention a chicken and the doves start getting really excited. So it means simply to lie down in a place, usually a place that has been sanctified in some particular way. Although sometimes it would happen that people with a really powerful consciousness, they could just fall down in the street or in a shop. They would just go into another state of consciousness, and we have beautiful stories about this, about how people didn't really understand what was happening. A lovely story I talked about in Switzerland early this year about this man Aristeas, who lived in it's in the Black Sea, now Turkey. He was a Greek, and he went into a particular shop, went into a state, fell down, and by the time the man who owned the shopkeeper had gone to get the relatives, of course they were coming to cart away a corpse, he'd actually gone, because you go into another state of consciousness. Sometimes an incubation, and then very, very strange things happen. Are you moving physically? Are you not? Are you moving in your body? Do you leave your body behind? God knows. This is one of these mysteries of incubation. What happens while we lie down? But literally, to incubate is to lie down. And some of you may say, well, what does lying down have to do with Sufism? So let me give you a few credentials here briefly, a few contextualizations here. First, I remember many moons ago, the first time I ever met Mrs. Tweedy in London. I traveled halfway across London to find her place. I'd been given her address. I got lost, I was late, and then I found this very, very ordinary looking house and a very, very ordinary looking street, except that there were hundreds of shoes outside the front door. And I went in and I just about managed to open the front door, and there were bodies filling the corridor, just corpses everywhere. There were bodies filling the living room, bodies filling the bedroom. The kitchen was full of bodies lying down. And the back room was full of bodies lying down. And Mrs. Tweedy was walking around, finding gaps to walk between the arms and the legs and the chests. She was walking around. She was the only person standing. She walked around like a lioness guarding her cubs. My God, she was fierce. You know, if anybody was going to come and disturb that space, they would be dead. So that was my first introduction to the Golden Sufis, incubation. And after that, in eastern Turkey, I remember being guided actually by, I was told to go to this place in Istanbul by a man I happened to meet. He was as surprised as I was. He was the 21st generation successor in the direct bloodline of Mevlana Rumi. And he told me when I went, he said, forget about going to Konya. I found this very interesting for a Mevlevi, not just for a Mevlevi, but for the peer of the Mevlevis, the head sheikh of the Mevlevis. He said, there's nothing in Konya. Dancing is a waste of time. Just a tourist trap. And he told me when I went to Eastern Turkey to go to this particular very, very hidden shrine. And when I found it, there were women lying in the soil. They'd come from Syria, from Jordan, from Iraq. And they would just come and lie in this particular very sacred shrine on the dirt, just sprawled there, waiting. And then just this morning, Pirzia told me again the details of how things have traditionally worked in his Chisti Sufi lineage. That actually the most advanced meditation posture in his line is amal, is lying down. And this is when everything dissolves, the attachment to the body dissolves. You go. And that is just what the ancient Greeks did. And you could say, well, it can't be a very dynamic state lying down. You know, because look at it, even when you sit up in meditation, it's a dynamic state. You need effort to keep in a good position, to keep your spine upright. You are fighting against gravity. We now are fighting against gravity. We're battling with these strange seats, and we're doing a fairly good job, probably quite a lot of strain on our musculature. But we do it because it's a conventional way of being together in a gathering. But lying down, no effort at all, what good is going to come out of that? Well, actually, okay, the creators of our Western civilization created it lying down. Let me just say that again. The creators of our Western culture created it lying down. That is how Western culture was brought into existence. That is the origin of all the sciences, of all the disciplines, of all of the structures, the substructures, the infrastructures of Western civilization. That's how it really happened. Everything else was messing around. And as Pierre Zia said this morning, you don't have to be psychic to see what happens when you mess around. We now live in the effects, the consequences of messing around with essentially the gifts of civilization which were given to great beings when they lay in incubation and were taken in another state of consciousness into another world so they could bring the gifts of that world into this world. And this is this fundamental paradox. There is nothing more dynamic than lying down. And if I want to say, well, how did the ancients find life? How did they find healing? How did they find hope? They found all of those things by lying down and dying. The secret the Sufis talk about is dying before you die. Now this sounds almost as if we're getting to talking about a technique, a practice here. And so immediately I have to come in and catch myself and say no. Incubation depends on the gods. Incubation depends completely and totally on the divine world. Incubation is a physical way of invoking the gods. This is to do with surrender. I don't know if any of you have experienced this. Maybe you all have. Maybe in times of great gloom or sadness or despair or crisis. If we lie down, sometimes if we just really lie down, the act of lying down is a silent prayer. Help me. And that is what incubation is. It is the heartfelt invocation of the divine through lying down. So incubation is not a practice. It's not a way. It's actually traditionally, it's the last resort. It's the last stop. You try everything else. If you want healing, you go all over the place, try to get healed, try to get the fix, go to your MD or the equivalent in the ancient world. And if you're fixed, wonderful. You don't need incubation. But when everything fails, or if you have a question that just won't go away and can't be answered, or if you have a longing that just will not be fulfilled by anything on the face of this earth, eventually you will find yourself in the dark places, in the shrine of a goddess or god, lying down, end of journey, last resort, last stopping place. This is not a technique, this is the end of techniques. But actually, if you are familiar enough inside yourself with that despair and familiar enough with that longing, you don't have to go through the whole stages every time. You just cut the whole process. You kind of cut the crap, if you excuse the language. You just say, okay, it's all up to the gods. So I just lie down, I give up, I'm not going to try and do anything. I just surrender. And that essentially is what incubation is. Whether you need to be healed, whether you need a question answered, whether you need company, whether you feel terribly lonely. It's one of these paradoxes. If you feel overwhelmed by loneliness, sometimes the best thing to do is to go down and lie in bed, and who knows, maybe the beloved will come and lie beside you in bed. But that's up to the beloved. But you see, if I say it all comes down to the gods and it's not a practice, it's not a technique, this actually is a little bit terrifying, to say the least. It can be quite scary. See, what we're actually doing is we're lying down. Once you lie down to incubate, you're no longer breathing or lying down on your own terms. You're lying down on their terms. And sometimes you don't even know on whose terms you're lying down. But you just have a sense it's no longer yours. Does this make sense to any of you? And this is this can be quite terrifying, because then it's like we take the gloves off and we're not going to have things pasteurized and nice and respectful. We lie down and we say, okay, I'm not in control here. I'm not even going to do anything here. And with the ancient Greeks, you can see the constant ambiguity of this situation. The surrender, the trust, and the fear. So, for example, one of the goddesses of incubation, especially in ancient Anatolia, Turkey, was she who prefers not to be named, but also goes by the name of Persephone. Queen of the Dead. And it's very, very beautiful to see that people would actually go and incubate in shrines of Persephone and her husband, Hades, because they needed life or because they needed healing. And there was this understanding that she, well, we could talk for hours about Persephone and say nothing. But she is the queen of the dead, and down there in the depths of the darkness, she smiles. Why do we die? Because the queen of death gets lonely. You know, she gives us 50, 60, 70 years to prance around on the surface of the earth, and then she says, oh, but I miss Barry, or I miss Teresa. Let's pull them back in so I can see them again. And then they go back, and she gets so fed up with their wantings and unsettlings and everything that she sends them back into existence. Go, you know, go off. You really want to. I see you really need to go off and get some more earthly experience. Okay, yawn, yawn. But, you know, when she gets lonely, she just pulls us back. But the beautiful thing is, and this is the ancient paradigm, this is the ancient sacred avenue, the avenue of the initiates, who knew how lonely Persephone is and knew that in order to preserve balance in the cosmos, they had to make the journey voluntarily before they die. They would go down through the fear, through the darkness, through the blackness, through the unending blackness, through even more blackness, through even more of it, because they knew and they trusted and they were absolutely convinced that at the heart of the darkness, see, this is the ancient secret now, the secret that used to be reserved for the initiates, at the heart of every darkness is a blinding light. And the darker the darkness, the more exquisite the light. And so they would go into the darkness of themselves. They would turn around, say, okay, I love the light, but I'm not going to be greedy for it, because that's just selfish. I'm going to go into the darkness. It looks crazy, it feels crazy, I really don't want to do this, but I know there's a higher purpose in this. And then she is there to greet you. And she says, thank you. She says, welcome. It was right that you came. This is the one way in which we humans can violate natural law, by dying before we die, if we do it in the right way. If we do it selflessly, we're allowed while still alive to go into the world of the dead and come back with the gifts of Persephone. And that's what the founders of our Western world did when they went down there and they were given by her the seeds, the gift of this Western world that was so selflessly brought back into this world and planted, and most of the seeds didn't really fall on very, very fertile ground, as we can see. But that's life. So Persephone has two sides. She's the queen of death, of everything you fear, everything. And then she, traditionally, her hand heals. If you're lucky enough to be touched by her hand, you will be healed. Unfortunately, some of us are touched by Persephone's hand and we're so terrified of it that we run away. And then we really create health problems for ourselves. But that's another story. And then, to take another divinity, there is Apollo. And one of Apollo's names as a god of incubation was Apollo Ulios, which is totally, absolutely, completely ambiguous in ancient Greek, and deliberately so. Scholars try to say, well, which is the real meaning? But you can see from the ancient Greeks, they knew that both meanings were real, and that's the important thing. Ulios means he who makes whole, holos, whole. He is the healer god. And Ulios also means the destroyer. So he is Apollo the healer who destroys, he is Apollo the destroyer who heals, and what's he going to do? God knows. That's the point. God knows what's going to happen with any of these gods, because it was understood that the source of life is in death. The secret of the light is in the darkness. There is no easy way, there is no easy path. It's risky, dangerous. But there were certain conventions for right behavior. And we're actually told very specifically that at some of these shrines, these great healing shrines, those who were welcomed by the gods were healed. But for others, it was deadly. So that means we have to be very conscious of our attitudes. You know, someone was suggested to me last week as a person who maybe we could do some work with. And when I looked his work up on the internet, I noticed that he does tours to Egypt. I was very interested. And he, in Egypt, he will give you, you know, in exchange for the airfare and whatever, he will give you initiation into the ancient mysteries. And that really worries me. I wish that we could give initiation. Maria and I could give initiation. We'd be really blooming. Business would be doing very well. And so many times we have to turn people away because, you know, they want the ancient Greek mysteries. And we say, well, sorry, you know, maybe, possibly, if. And by the time you get to the end of the sentence and all the conditions, they're gone because they just want the initiation. I don't know if any human can give an initiation. Certainly not without confirmation from somewhere else. So there are no guarantees in incubation. You notice there are no guarantees in life. It's kind of a nice parallel there. But on the other hand, there is something so mysteriously exquisite about this practice, which is no practice of incubation. And what I love about it, one of the things, and I've seen this happen repeatedly, is incubation is not a practice, but what it actually is, strictly speaking, is it is something you can do so that possibly you will be given the practice that is unique for you. And that is how traditionally it works. You lie down, whether you want to become pregnant or you have a pain in your knee or you just want to be one with the divine. It doesn't matter. Somewhere you're sick. You're not whole. And what happens is there is this direct contact in this state of incubation, in this nothingness. There is this direct contact which is for you and you alone. You are spoken to in a way that is for you and you alone. I was 16 years ago in incubation, I was shown a meditation practice, which I've done since then, and it seemed preposterous because it was just so, so strange. I'd never heard or read about it. Actually, a few years after that, I read some unpublished lectures by Mrs. Tweedy, and she actually said, she described how Bysarp, a teacher, had mentioned this. It's very strange. But there is this intimacy where something is given just for you, to you, totally personally. We may not trust it, it's a bit of a problem. But this is how the gods can speak to us. This is the ancient way in which the gods speak. And they may say, create a civilization. You say, what? And, you know, that, like to say that may sound like a big deal to us. It's really not a big deal. From the divine perspective, creating a civilization is peanuts. They just see all this as playing in the sand. You know, we get so caught up in the dramas of our culture. Poof, it's nothing. When you start to see things from the divine perspective, it's just like a child playing a game of chess, as one of the ancient Greeks said. And of course, when a child plays a game of chess, the child doesn't really know the rules very well. So it's just kind of chaos. But it looks nice. You know, if you see a child playing with a chess set, you know, they really enjoy the shape of the castle. They love the shape of the king and the queen. It becomes very tactile and very real, but there are no rules. And that's really what we live in. Chaos with vague hints of law and regulation somewhere behind. And just one other thing, I think, before we do this, that I would like to say. When we go into incubation, we actually go inside our own body. We realize eventually there's nowhere else to go. It's this very, very strange situation we've come to, which I actually find quite apocalyptic. I mean, you can talk about hope in this culture or whatever, but we don't realize what we've lost in our own bodies. We don't realize that every spiritual experience that we or anybody can ever have in their lifetimes is going to happen in their own body. You can't have a spiritual experience unless you are aware of it, unless you feel it, unless you sense it. It's not that the senses are the problem, it's that we don't know how to use our senses. This is a whole subject in itself. An extraordinary mystery. We just really don't understand. We've been conned so much. You know, our bodies are evil and we should feel guilty about our bodies, and high spiritual states mean leaving our body behind. No, you go, don't leave your body behind. You go deep, deep, deep inside, and you leave the illusion of a physical body behind. But you don't leave your real body behind, which is the sensation inside all of us right now. The dark, grainy texture inside our fingers, at our fingertips. If you shut your eyes, the way that you know or think that you know you have feet or buttocks or shoulders or arms or legs or a head or a nose is because of your sensation. Sensation is the bedrock of our being. It's the most primordial form of consciousness. And when we go into incubation and become a little bit experienced in going into incubation, we realize what we're doing is we're actually going into the darkness of our own sensation, which takes us down into this vast, infinite inner body, which starts being our own inner body, but ends up being the whole body of the universe. If you go inside your own sensation deep enough, you will discover there is only one sensation. Your sensation is everybody else's sensation. Your sensation is the sensation of the wood made to create this building. Your sensation is the sensation of the earth. This is how we feel. This is how we are compassionate. This is how we resonate through the sensation inside us, which is the bedrock of intuition, of consciousness, of experience, of everything. And what we do usually is when we wake up When we go to sleep, we go inside our own sensation, into that darkness. Maybe we have dreamless sleep, maybe we have dreams inside that darkness of our own sensation. But when we wake up, we come out and we are looking at all the colors and shapes and forms and getting very excited and involved with the good things and the bad things and the nice experiences and the really awful, rotten experiences. But it is actually possible to stay inside the darkness inside us, to keep that contact with the underworld. It's actually to stay in contact with the soil of our being, to be in the darkness while we are out here in the world. And talking with people I know who have done this, they confirm to me it's actually a very, very fertile place to be. Your awareness becomes much sharper. You are much more intuitive. You're much, much more aware of what's going on in the room, in the house, in the area. You actually start, you don't have to think about it. I remember a month or two ago in the house we just moved into, I was talking with somebody in one room in our house, and then there was a friend who was helping to break up some tiles by the front door. And then we had a crew of guys downstairs who were reinforcing the foundations of the house. And as I was talking to this person, I physically became aware that the hammering of our friend who was chipping away at the tiles by the front door was making life very, very difficult for the people downstairs in the basement. I was aware of what I was doing, talking with that person. I was aware of all these things simultaneously, and I had to stop that person. Nobody else thought about it. And when I went down to the crawl space, yes, it was really hard for them because there was someone chiseling right above them. But you start to become more aware of what is going on all around you by being in this soil of yourself. And the other thing I would just say as we are here at a conference is that to be in the depths, to be in the darkness of your own sensation. Well, let me say this. To wait patiently in the darkness of your own body is a tremendous exercise in selflessness and egolessness. Once you get involved in all the excitement of spiritual life and the light shows and the stimulations, then the personality, the ego, gets really caught up and very, very excited, and suddenly, before you know it, spiritual life has become an affair for the spiritual personality. And then you have a spiritual ego, and then, God forbid. But actually, if you just humbly, patiently wait in the darkness of your own being, you start to realize that it actually destroys this projective part of one that becomes so important, so self-important. And it is very beautiful too, because to stay in the darkness of one's own being, to wait there, is a tremendous reality check. It actually helps you to go deeper into whatever practice, whatever tradition you follow. There are no contradictions. We're talking here at such a simple, primal, primordial level. There are no contradictions between different traditions. There can seem to be, but there aren't. It's just the mind might try and separate things out, but truly, there are not. It's like yesterday Llewellyn mentioned the different levels, the different veils, the different stages in going deeper and deeper into the heart. Now, the first stage, kalp, the physical, fleshy heart. Well, how are you going to know when you leave that behind and go into the second stage, the ruh, the more spiritual, the deeper side of the heart? How do you know? Now, to begin with, you will know because you go into this place of deeper stillness, of deeper peace. But what happens when you meditate the next time? How do you know that you really are in that peace rather than your kalp creating an illusion that you are in the ruh? You know, because this is one side of Sufism that I think we really need to bring out. It's often forgotten. As Ibn Arabi said, God is a trickster. The divine trick, makr, is very, very powerful. And even love, even devotion has its dangers. It's easier to see it in other people, or maybe in other traditions. It's harder to see it inside ourselves. But love has its dangers. And if God is a trickster, then a sheikh is a trickster too. And how do you know when your sheikh is tricking you or not? How do you know? Maybe your sheikh feels that the best thing for you is that you keep in your illusion and you keep on churning on in your projections for the rest of your life. You know, sometimes the best thing for a sheikh to do is not interfere. Just, you know, let them get on with their projections, get on with whatever they do. Let them live through their particular dramas and illusions. I'm not going to get in the way. That's your responsibility. I'm not going to take on your karmas. You know? So how do we know that we're not even creating an illusory projection around our teacher? How do we know that we're not making something illusory around the path that we follow? How do we know that the heart is not tricking us? Because the heart, the kalp, can trick us. See, because the kalp, the first stage, it does not want us to leave it behind. And either it can put up a big fuss and really create a big struggle, or else it can actually create the illusion that you've gone beyond it, whereas you still stay in the first stage. God is a trickster. And one of the most beautiful things about sensation is it is a reality check. If you stay selflessly in this darkness and you just go inside, you will be shown if you are making something out of nothing. You'll be shown if you're making something out of something else. Our bodies, our earth, our soil does not lie. If you stay with it long enough, it has to reveal the truth. It will guide you. It will confirm. And of course, this really comes down to sincerity. And really, all I ask is that when we lie down now, we just lie down in complete sincerity. That is all. Is there any hope in lying down? No, but out of hopelessness comes hope. Is there any life in lying down? No, it's as close as we can get as human beings to being corpses. But the life, the depth of life that can come is extraordinary. So let's just try it for a while, and then when we've incubated for a while, we can have any questions if anybody wants any or any experiences. Bless you all. And there's some space up here. There's a little bit of carpet. If two or three people want to come up here, you're welcome to do so. And there are some more blankets at the back.